Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
My guest today is a working-class boy from Dundee who left school at 16 and has somewhat improbably, in the light of his early life, emerged as one of the leading voices in poetry today. He's frowning.
Oh, I think of myself as middle class now, but it's just, it was a long road.
Good note. He is, of course, Don Paterson, and his latest collection, Rain, was shortlisted for the Forward Poetry Prize before it was even published, putting him in line for yet another in a long line of prizes which stretch back to his very first collection. Welcome, Don.
Hi, Claire.
The middle class Don. Am I right in thinking this is your fifth original collection?
It might be the fourth. I think it's probably the fourth. Now, I've had a couple of books of versions of other poets and a couple of books of aphorisms, so it depends how you count it.
How you can. We'll come back to those a bit later. It's your first, anyway, since Landing Light, which got you the Whitbread Poetry Prize. And between then, you managed to fit in a collection of Rilke's sonnets, Sonnets to Orpheus.
Yeah.
So you're quite busy, really.
I seem to have gotten busy in my 40s. I think it's because I was so slack for the first 15 years. It's, you know, you can see sort of death looming, hopefully, a couple of decades off, and you think, well, better get the finger out.
And eventually, like Geoffrey Hill, you'll get to your 80s and start doing more than you've ever done in your entire life.
That's the plan, anyway. Yeah, but I'm already doing that, so, yep.
The rocket-powered, rocket-propelled them.
Fingers crossed.
To give listeners an idea of the character of the collection, I wondered whether you'd be so good as to read the title poem, Rain.
Sure. Rain. I love all films that start with rain. Rain braiding a window pane, or darkening a hung-out dress, or streaming down her upturned face. One big thundering downpour, right through the empty script and score, before the act, before the blame, before the lens pulls through the frame to where a woman sits alone beside a silent telephone, or the dress lies ruined on the grass, or the girl walks off the overpass, and all things flow out from that source along their fatal watercourse. However bad or overlong, such a film can do no wrong. So when his native twang shows through, or when the boom dips into view, or when her speech starts to betray its adaptation from the play, I think to when we opened cold in a starlit gutter, running gold with a neon of a drugstore sign, and I'd read into its blazing line, forget the ink, the milk, the blood, all was washed clean with a flood. We rose up from the falling waters, the fallen rain's own sons and daughters, and none of this matters.
Thank you. Well, that seems characteristic in that it runs a line through from popular to classical references, and through from, so it's from film to a sort of untethered meditation. Tell me a bit about that process.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, again, it's one of those things you don't notice until it's written. You know, it's just Randall Jarrell always used to say that, you know, writing a poem is a way of forgetting how you wrote it. You know, and it's just, and it's true that, you know, after you finish it, you've got no idea how it ended up the way that it does. But you can see the sort of cadence that, or the shape in the air that you've kind of made, you know. And I think most poems do that. They're on a kind of slow gradient, you know. They don't really work if they go the other way, you know.
So are you a particular film buff?
A film buff would be, or a cinephile, that would be too strong. No, absolutely not. I just watch far too many films. They're all crap. And if it calls itself a film, I'll sit in front of it. If it's good as well. But I mean, like last night I was watching in the hotel, what was it? Four Brothers with Mark Wahlberg. It's a terrible film, but I sat and watched it all the way through. But I became conscious, you know, a while back, if it's raining at the start, it puts me in a very good mood and I'll just sit and
watch. Well, it's sort of film noir, really, isn't it?
It sets itself up like that. It could be garbage and I'll just sort of sit through it, you know, and I was trying to work out why it made me feel so good, this kind of opening shot of rain, which is a kind of standard trope, of course, but it's great.
Now, this is the poem it's the title poem, but you've put it right at the end of the collection. Why did you do that?
I think it's one of those things you just felt somehow that was the place for it to go, and it tied together the concerns of the book. And I think there's a, and also it's a sad wee book. And I guess there's a wee redemptive note in that poem, and I think that's a better note to finish on, or a, you know, a more positive one. You know, that's the way I wanted it to finish. I didn't want to end on a miserable note because it could have done at several points.
So, is your poetry getting sadder?
No, I had a bad case of life, really, you know, between Landing Light and Rain, and inevitably, you know, your book's gonna I think of it as just one big book you publish in instalments, but inevitably each instalment's going to reflect, you know, what's happened in the...
Yeah, so there's the biographical element that's
there's always going to be, even if you try and keep it out. You know, it's going to have, you know, sort of informed or actually dictated more of the content than you'd like to admit.
Mm. Now, you're also a musician and you came here clutching a guitar, hot foot from Dresden. That's partly why I was interested in the ordering. I happened to have been listening to something on the radio this morning in which Paul Gambaccini was talking about the fact that Vera Lynn is at the top of the charts because only older people actually buy albums now. Right, so how, I mean, this must impact on a poetry collection. How, you know, can you choose the ordering? Can you choose the shape of an overall collection?
Yeah, you do. I don't know how much point there is, really, given that if you're anything like me, you don't read a book from start to finish. In fact, one of the nice things about the book of poems is you can usually open it anywhere. You know, and I think most poetry readers kind of enjoy that kind of reading. You know, just the serendipity of it, and then you come back to it and you open it somewhere else. And Larkin always used to say, in fact, it was Douglas Dunn that told me this, because Larkin told him, and he was panicking about how to arrange his first book, Terry Street, and Larkin says, good one at the start, good one at the end, throw the others up in the air because nobody cares.
As somebody who was judging a poetry award said, oh, just read the first and the last and then you know whether it's worth reading the rest.
Well, I mean, the bottom line is that's the most prominent sort of position in the book, and you're going to, you know, probably try and put your best poems, you know, in that position, you know, and bury the duff ones two-thirds of the way through. That's traditional as well. That's what I tell my authors anyway. So.
Does your music influence your poetry?
I used to think it didn't at all, and I took this stupid line, it's just these two things that you happen to end up doing, and it could be any two things, but I think after a while, it doesn't matter what two things you do, they end up informing each other and mapping, you know, sort of techniques onto each other despite yourself, so that, yeah, they do. But just because of the way that you listen to things, so I think, you know, if you've had a kind of musical training, then you do get very attuned to certain properties of language more than others, certain acoustic qualities of sound. Mm. I tend to obsess over those, maybe too much, you know.
Do you write lyrics as well as poetry?
No, I can't. I've tried, and I gave up when I was about 20 because I realised I could never do it because I can't leave any space for the music. No.
Now, one of the most unusual poems in this, for you, it seems to me, is the song for, I can't pronounce her name, Natalie Tuja Berishte. Is that how you pronounce it?
Better than my effort. I'll have your pronunciation.
And that really interested me because I couldn't work out whether you were frightened by technology or seduced by it, whether you liked it or disliked it.
Definitely seduced. Just a complete, you know, technophile.
Tell us a bit about the poem.
It's sort of about music. It's just like I happen to be an admirer of this woman's work. She's a fantastic programmer, a brilliant electronic musician working in electronica. But also, it's about how music's changed, and about how the same romance that used to attach itself to guitars and saxophones is now in software and computers.
But it also has, it's given us a whole lot of words, hasn't it? Sort of moogie sort of words, I think of them as.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how, you know, any jargon, I think, is musically consistent, you know, and digital technology, music technology jargon is very singular and particular, and it has its own kind of noise, which I kind of love, you know. So it's not meant to be that readily comprehensible a poem, but, you know, it's just a, hopefully it makes a kind of pleasant racket, you know.
And underlying it, I thought I could discern a feeling that all this technical gadgetry actually takes the person, the performer, further away from the person listening to it. And actually, in the end, it makes you more lonely.
Oh, I hope not. But I mean, the thing is, that you might read it that way. And I think that, I mean, that's entirely possible. It has the opposite effect for me, just because, as I say, you end up mapping all the same feelings onto this stuff as you did onto your strings and your guitar.
So now you've got a lot of popular culture in your poetry. Let's talk a little bit about seriousness. It is very serious. Underlying it is very serious, isn't it?
Yeah, I suspect it's always serious and the other stuff, you know, is there leaven the misery. But yeah, I mean, I think it's maybe a slightly more serious book than the last, or it's a sadder book.
You said you started writing poetry to impress women once.
Did I?
You did.
I must have met it at the time. I would have been disabused of that pretty quick. I guess that sounds like the thought of a young man, doesn't it? It's a different...
Well, also, maybe it was an age when poetry did impress women.
Yeah, well, that's pretty bad, actually. The early 90s were a very funny time. Yeah.
Didn't Vogue put poets on the cover at one point?
Oh, God, we were in Vogue. There was a Vogue shoot around about 1984. It was just a disaster. Like, you know, I think it was the last time they put poets in Vogue, so...
You've also talked about modernism and how poets have been alienated from their readers by the fact that you can no longer trust anyone to say anything big. Everything's been cut up. A mistrust of the profound.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an awful complicated argument, and it's just like, and you know, and I've gotten into trouble in the past when I've sort of paraphrased it and ended up simplifying it into a lie. So, I mean, but you have to be careful. For whatever reasons, you know, readers can't... They don't read poetry as a kind of reliable form of discourse anymore. They think that a poem is an excuse to have a conversation about poetry or to read it through some kind of biographical lens rather than just taking what it says on trust and using that as something to engage directly with.
I was interested by the first poem in the collection, Two Trees, which seemed to be sort of... in a way, you are sending up a very serious approach from your readers. This, tell us a bit about Two Trees.
I don't know how that happened, really. You know, I certainly didn't intend to send it up at the end, but other people have read it that way. What it is basically, it's a kind of, it comes on like a little allegorical story, which is half true at least, about these two trees that it was actually written under these two trees in Spain that this guy grafted together. One was a lemon and one was an orange tree. And it looked like one tree with two fruits. And then this guy comes along and chops it in half. And it's about how the trees might have fell afterwards. So it's looking at this kind of pathetic fallacy and about, you know, sort of, and denying that's taken place. But I think it's a much more serious poem than that, you know, but that only struck me afterwards. It's an exasperation, I think, with the fact that we always read human sentiment into the world, you know, and as I was doing on this occasion.
You could see it as a riposte to Larkin's Arundel Tomb poem in
You could in a way, but unfortunately, well, not unfortunately, but I think it actually ends, there's also one interpretation that absolutely sides with it. I don't know what to make of that poem. I think that's a good thing. I'm happiest with poems.
So you're happy that you, when you don't understand your own poetry, are you?
I'm most happy then, because that means that the meaning is probably a bit more open than the ones that I think I do fully understand. And if the meaning's open, there's more chance that someone's going to be able to read their own emotion and experience into it than one that's closed.
Now, the final two lines of this poem, for people who don't know it, is... They were trees, and trees don't weep or ache or shout, and trees are all this poem is about.
Oh, you can never trust a poet. I mean, anyone that says that trees are all this poem is about is clearly lying. You know, so it's just like, so I don't think that's what it's about at all, am I saying that?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but it is that in a lot of these poems, there's a sort of bob-along quality, which I kept thinking, oh, what's going on here? It seems very light, and it's very neatly scanned and rhymed.
That's partly... There are reasons for doing that. It's partly compositional, which is that, you know, I've got the same... I mean, Yeats used to talk about that. He said if it wasn't for rhyme, he wouldn't know what the next line was going to be, you know, and I'm just exactly the same. It's the sort of engine of getting the thing written, as in just getting carried away with the rhythm and thinking about how the hell you're going to rhyme that line. And it pulls out content that you wouldn't have got out of yourself any other way. It draws things out of your brain that you wouldn't have gotten to. And it actually allows you to say things that you wouldn't have dared because you're trying to make a seamless rhyme. So it actually injects an awful lot of chaos, you know, on the semantic front for a lot of order on the acoustic front. So that's the sort of playoff there. So and it also makes folk feel weirdly uncomfortable, which you wouldn't think it did. I mean, as you say, it's all quite regular and neat, or at least as neat as I could get it. But these days, that actually makes
it's quite rare,
feel
isn't
a wee
it?
Bit awkward.
Yeah,
there's a lot more of us doing it, I think, than there were 30 years ago. But it's,
now you've also published two collections of aphorisms, and there are 35 aphorisms in this book. Tell me first what aphorisms are, just in case anybody doesn't know.
It's just like, it's been something I've tried to define for a long time. I've got my own definition of an aphorism, which is like a sort of, it's a kind of self-proving statement. It says something and proves it at the same time. I think the ones in the book aren't really aphorisms. I thought of them more as poems, but they are very short, but they're a sort of like Anglophone version of a Japanese model. A couplet and a haiku and a couplet. Mm.
But each one contains a whole thought about death.
That's right.
Death,
I mean, they're all closed. Yeah, and they're all about sort of the previous deaths of the 35 previous existences.
And there was the one I particularly liked was, here's your book back, world, good story. I underlined a few things. Sorry, it would sound better in your accent than in mine. that's sort of very sly, it struck me. I mean, there's a slyness in this collection.
It's a sly wee form, Japanese forms, yeah.
But now, as well as that, you've got some very personal stuff in this. There's, in particular, there are a couple of poems written to your son, your twin sons.
Yeah.
one of which refers to the fact that one of your sons, that they obviously had a very difficult birth.
Jamie did. Russell was fine. He just popped out and Jamie had got stuck.
And and he has been injured by it.
Very, very slightly. I mean, he doesn't think of himself that way, and neither does anyone else. But it's left this tiny little tremor that, you know, it's actually kind of cool. You know, it's like it's more of a plus.
And I wondered, they're very, very tender poems, and I wondered if you could perhaps read us one of the shorter ones.
Sure. Yeah. This isn't. This refers to Jamie, but I suspect it's more about the author. Correctives. The shudder in my son's left hand, he cures with one touch from his right. Two fingertips laid feather light to still his pen. He understands the whole man must be his own brother, for no man is himself alone, though some of us have never known the one hand's kindness to the other.
That is really lovely. Sort of brings tears to the eyes. But before we start crying, we'll move on. I noticed that in profiles and interviews, people are very coy about talking about biographical detail. And yet you do have biography in these poems.
I do, but, you know, it's as much as one wants to say, I think, you know, is what's there in the poem. There's less than there appears, I suspect. And some of it, of course, I mean, it's just like it's just unreliable, you know. I mean, you can't trust a poet to
well, for example, did you buy a bathysphere and put it in your garden?
No, I didn't.
No, I definitely didn't.
It's the sort of thing I might have done had I the wherewithal.
This is a poem about a bathysphere, which is a diving bell.
Yeah, it's about a guy who buys a bathysphere.
So it's like a little dramatisation of someone doing it.
Yeah, it's a sort of weird little dramatic monologue about a guy who buys this thing and rolls it up a hill and sits in it. And I'm not entirely sure what that one's about either. I think it's about the aesthetic something process. I really don't know what it's about.
Yes, it's a funny idea of him sitting in his driveway, imagining that he's being hauled up to the surface of the ocean. Well, that's how I do.
Yeah, that's the scenario. But again, that's what's going on there.
Now, as well as you do play games, obviously, you're talking about the unreliable poet, narrator, but it's quite a serious theoretician, aren't you? You teach creative writing, you've edited the Picador poetry list, and you have a sense of the baton being handed down, that you belong to a tradition.
Yeah, I think so. And it's an interesting time to be sort of, you know, at any university and talking about these things at the moment, because the whole subject of poetic composition and ars poetica is opening up to a lot of other fields as well, and some amazing insights coming through just now from linguistics and cognitive science that are shedding an awful lot of light on things, but it turns out we barely understood.
Such as?
Well, to do with the way that metaphor works. The way that mental spaces map themselves onto one another, the way in which there are parts of the brain where sound and sense are kind of the same thing, you know, they're much, you know, that again, there's crosstalk between bits of the brain that deal with these things, and that poetry happens in a space that's in between and almost considers sound and sense as the same thing in a particular kind of reading. And it turns out that a lot of the ideas we had about how poems work, I think, are just simply wrong, because we didn't have the information. So it's an interesting time to have these things in play.
Mm.
You know?
A few of these poems, you are after someone else, after Cavafy, after Li Po, Chinese poet.
Aye.
8th century Chinese poet, Li Po. What does that mean? What does after mean?
It means, it means it could cover a multitude of sins is what it means. It's it could either be a close sort of version or a very distant version or just a mere homage to the poet. So I think every poem has a different relationship to the original.
So could you read it without ever having read Li Po?
Well, that's absolutely the idea, is that it stands on its own in English. That's the idea of the version, as opposed to the translation, which I think you'd have to read it sort of alongside the original.
Mm. It struck me that one of the things you do is you will allude to, for example, Dante or one of these after poets, and use it as a shortcut to something that's actually quite profound, without actually having to go into to embarrass yourself with getting very profound.
I hadn't noticed it. It's quite possibly true that I'm hitching a ride in the coattails of these big poets.
Just, you know, if you mention in the middle of the walk of our life, you're going to end up with something which is metaphysical, don't you?
Yeah, I guess so. It's difficult, isn't it? The whole business of illusions. It's how much do you presume that, you know, sort of, do you presume that we share, you know? Because you don't want to say stuff that people don't know, because it's just absurd. So I tend to stick to the things that we've probably read that we'll have in common, you know. Mm.
And there's a poem here which is a meditation on Zurbaran's St. Francis in Meditation. It's a rather gruesome painting of St. Francis with a skull that people might, a very brown.
Yeah, it's a great painting. I got really obsessed with that. And that's from a long elegy for Michael Donaghy. An early version of that poem appeared in a catalogue that of Alison Watt's paintings that she did while she had a residency at the National. And we both got totally obsessed with this particular Zurbaran painting, which, as you say, is a grim but incredibly attractive picture as well. But it's very, very dark, you know. And the way he's holding the skull is really strange. It's looking up at him as he looks up into the dark of his own cowl. And that seemed to be a sort of a metaphor for the form of address that I ended up using in the elegy itself, and, you know, the whole business of addressing the dead and ventriloquizing the dead, you know. Mm.
Are you religious? You talk about this crap of souls and ghosts and God.
No, I'm a hardcore scientific materialist, really.
But you were religious in your youth.
I was religious. I mean, this is the trouble with the ex-religious, of course. They turn into anti-theists and atheism.
Religiously anti-theist.
It's like, I've got it in for the guy, you know. I do believe in spirituality. I'm a sort of, you know, philosophically a kind of, you know, neutral monist, you know. I think that, you know, the spiritual arises from the material, you know, and it feeds back into the material, but I think it's all matter at the end of the day. I think it was a big bang and that was it, you know? It's just stuff talking in The Guardian, you know. It's great. It's amazing the way things pan out, isn't it? It's just
you end up in a little glass box in King's Cross. Don Patterson, thank you very much for coming in. And just to end this podcast, he will read another poem from the collection, The Error.
The Error. As the bird is to the air and the whale is to the sea, so man is to his dream. His world is just the glare of the world's utility returned by his eye-beam. Each self-reflecting mind is in this manner destined to forget its element. And this is why we find, however deep we listen, that the skies are silent.